United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today via video conference by Judge Greenberg and Judge Allen. We're convened today for the matter of Thurman Fuller Jr. versus Robert L. Wilkie, docket number 18-7000. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Victoria Donta of the law firm Duane Morris, LLP, appearing for appellant Thurman Fuller. And with me is my colleague Samuel Apicelli, also of the law firm Duane Morris.
Thank you, Ms. Donta.
Ronan Morris for the secretary, and joining me is Deputy Chief Counsel James Cowden.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. As you know, each party will have 30 minutes to present their arguments. Ms. Donta, do you want to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 10 minutes, please.
Okay, that's fine. We'll make that happen. You may proceed, Ms. Donta, when you're ready.
Thank you very much, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to begin by roadmapping the particular relief that Appellant Thurman Fuller speaks, that is, the particular orders he'd like from this court, followed by overviews of the interplay between the issues, facts, and points of law, unless there are issues that the panel would like to hear addressed immediately. The issues from our perspective in order of importance are whether the court has standing, whether Mr. Fuller has standing, the effective date for any apportionment claim, whether the regional office violated Mr. Fuller's rights by failing to notify him after deeming his attempt and claim abandoned after 1 year, whether the regional office failed to assist Mr. Fuller according to the circumstances of his incarceration, whether the regional office should have been given a presumption of regularity in the performance of their duties to the Fullers, and whether remand is appropriate for any issues where there are insufficient reasons and bases in the appeal decision. In terms of the particular order Mr. Fuller seeks, there are four types of relief. The first is affirmation of his standing to pursue the appeal based on the non-clearly erroneous factual findings of the board that he is married to Mrs. Fuller, that Mrs. Fuller lives in California, that California is a community property jurisdiction, and that Mr. Fuller suffered an indirect economic injury from the denial of an earlier effective date for apportionment, because the apportionment entered their marital estate.
Ms. Donta, this is Judge.
Yes.
I just have a factual question. Can you confirm for us that the Fullers are in fact still married?
They are still married.
And Mrs. Fuller remains a resident of the state of California?
Yes, she remains a resident of the state of California.
Thank you.
The second type of relief Mr. Fuller seeks is reversal of the conclusion that August 1st, 2009 is the earliest effective date that could apply to an apportionment claim. This includes recognizing that Mr. Fuller submitted a claim or an intent to file a claim in March 2004 when the regional office told him the reduction of his benefits due to his incarceration, and he promptly replied within 2 weeks with enough information for the RO to know that he wanted his wife to receive benefits, that his wife lived in California, that his information might be at least 5 years old and dating from his start of incarceration in 1999, and that he had a property interest in the apportionment through the marital estate. This also includes evaluating whether Mr. Fuller's due process rights were violated by the failure to receive a notice or any opportunity to be heard after the RO deemed the claim abandoned, but never told either of the Fullers. The third type of relief is the reversal of the board's application of the presumption of validity, because there is not just the assertion that Mrs. Fuller never received the single letter the regional office sent her, but facts that are immediately apparent from the Fuller's forms that Mrs. Fuller's address was old and outdated, and it wouldn't be reasonable to rely on just it alone to satisfy the RO's duties. Finally, Mr. Fuller seeks an order of remand if the court finds there are not sufficient reasons or bases to issue the other forms of release just discussed, because, for example, we can't tell if the RO followed its established procedures for verifying claimants' financial information or their locations, because there's no discussion of what the established procedures are in the appeal decision. If it pleases the court, I'd like to turn first to the issue of standing because that determines whether the court can reach any of the other substantive issues on appeal. As a preliminary matter, the parties all agree on the standard that applies. Mr. Fuller would have standing to appeal, pursue the appeal if non-clearly erroneous fact findings support a conclusion that he has a personal stake in the outcome. Here, those fact findings are that he was married, he was incarcerated.
Ms. Donta,
yes.
I hate to interrupt you, but I do have a question related to this. And that is,
do we need to
get to all of the arguments that you raised in your brief? I noticed that in Judge Meredith's single judge decision in this case, there were statements from Ms. Fuller that the veteran was her legal guardian and that she wished him to pursue, she had wished him to pursue the whole thing on his own without regard to her. Does that affect the standing issue at all?
I think it does to the extent that as a legal guardian, Mr. Fuller would be able to file the claim himself as the claimant, which is one of the arguments that the secretary raises why there aren't any errors with the board decision on the issue of the effective date. I still think it's helpful to think of the other way that if he is her legal guardian, then his standing would derive from her property interest. And so I think standing is established. If that is not something that the court is prepared to order, then I think he still has standings according to the reasons set forth in the appealed board decision, that he has an indirect economic interest in the apportionment that derives from the marital estate they share in California.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I have a question, if I may.
Of course.
Why wouldn't you agree with the statement that a veteran always has standing in this court to deal with issues related to his status as a veteran? Economic in particular.
I do agree that a veteran always has standing to raise issues that go to his status. Perhaps I'm misunderstanding your question.
You're not. My question is, I'm suggesting you that I would have taken a broader approach to the question of standing. That
certainly
doesn't mean you have to agree with me. It certainly doesn't mean my colleagues have to agree with me. But my view is, what's wrong with the proposition that a veteran always has standing, particularly in the context of an appeal from a decision of the secretary or a subordinate part of the department to bring his case here?
I am not opposed to taking a broader position on standing, certainly. We were conceiving of it in the narrower terms of the appeal of the apportionment decision. I would recognize that the apportionment derives from the veteran's benefits that result from his service and his service connection. And to that extent, I think his interests are always impacted when there's an issue of apportionment, regardless of certain cases cited by the secretary that would seem to require an evaluation of the connection between the veteran and the apportionment.
I'm not going to belabor the point, but I'm asking you to reject that position out of hand, the secretary's position.
I do reject this.
And adopt my thought. But you don't have to. That is, a veteran always has standing. Standing should never be an issue if we're talking about an economic benefit. Isn't that a matter almost of constitutional dimension?
I would make the arguments I would make both in the alternative. I think that the veteran does always have standing, and if the court were to determine in its decision that that wasn't the case, he still has standing based on the narrower view.
Ms. Donta?
Thank you.
We had issued a briefing order, or a be prepared to discuss.
Yes, Your Honor.
From the Supreme Court of the United States in a case called Mizell versus Mizell, I'm probably mispronouncing that. That's an interesting decision for me, because it seems that Justice Marshall for the court in that case, the majority, seems to distinguish between, in that case, pure military retirement pay, which then became subject to state community property law, in response to an earlier Supreme Court case that said it wasn't. And the court was very careful in that, in the second case, Mizell, to say apparently that Congress changed the state of the play with respect to pure military retirement pay, but did not sufficiently make the elected portion where you waive retirement pay to get disability benefits. The disability benefits portion, the Supreme Court held in Mizell, was not subject to state community property law. What do you say about that? Because that's a pretty serious issue for me.
Well, I would start by recognizing that Mizell involves a different federal statute, and the opinion of the Supreme Court focused very heavily on the statutory language of that particular statute and its legislative history in order to interpret it. It began with a very broad recognition that domestic relations law is traditionally the province of states, and that it's in a rare instance that Congress intends to displace state authority in that area. So I'm not in favor of applying Mizell broadly to hold that any type of disability benefits are necessarily precluded from being treated as community property law.
So could I jump in at that point? Because this follows on to Judge Greenberg's question, okay? Because one of the interesting things for me in reading the Mizell case, was that the Supreme Court was talking about essentially what it assumed Congress was trying to get at with military retirement pay, which is what it said in McCarty, right? Mm-hmm. Congress steps in and says, no, right? And it was looking at broader incentives, right? In other words, it was mm-hmm. concerned actually with an anti-veteran result as a general matter if it allowed division in community property. So we are in an interesting position here, because you're making an argument that says, no, this thing should be able to be divided in community property, which gives me the right to pursue the claim. And so in this case, Mr. Fuller's case, standing alone, there's no question that that rule would be favorable to him, right? But if we adopt a rule that veterans' benefits are subject to community property law across the United States, in the overwhelming number of situations, that would be not that veteran friendly, because it would allow a spouse in California to get divorced from a veteran who's getting benefits and say, no, those benefits now, half of them have to go to me because they're community property. And I say that not because it's result-driven, but the logic of the Supreme Court cases, both in McCarty, when it took the position it did and then was partially reversed by the Supreme Court, by the Congress, and then in Mizell, was concerned in the broader case that if we make benefits that are tied either to military service, the McCarty case, or disability benefits, it would be at odds with what Congress is trying to do. This case is counterfactual, of course, because in this case, it would help Mr. Fuller. But what would you say to the response that if we ruled broadly that if you have somebody who is 100% service connected for PTSD who happens to be in California, that then under the position you're advocating, California law would say 50% of that goes to the spouse as part of the community property divorce domestic relations settlement. So I am concerned about that, not just as a result, but because it goes to the logic, I think, of the Supreme Court's thinking.
Okay. What I think is important about those observations is that my understanding of the apportionment statute is not necessarily to benefit either spouse, but to support military families in financial need while a veteran is incarcerated. I also think it's noteworthy that the Fullers remain buried.
Could you just one point? I agree. I'm going in baby steps here.
Yes.
Because you've jumped to a point that's a little different, right? Which is, and this is not a criticism because I've thought about this case for a year with all the medical issues among counsel, mm-hmm. right? Is you're talking about the apportionment. It is conceivable that a rule that applies to veterans' benefits writ large might not apply in the same way to apportionment, right? Leave that aside for a moment. My question is broader. Okay, because if in fact Manziel from the Supreme Court in combination with McCarty means that those two cases together say veteran disability benefits are not subject to community property law, then the next question would be for me, is there a distinction in the concept of apportioned, right? Apportionment. Go to my bigger question. In the context of simply veterans benefits, Mr. or Mrs. X lives in California and is a veteran, has a benefit, they divorce, right? Is it your position that the benefits that the veteran is in receipt of, generically, are subject to state community property division?
I don't think I can take a position without qualifying that it's important to look at the type. It depends on the type of benefits involved, because these benefits are set up by distinct statutes with distinct statutory language with separate legislative histories that aid in their interpretation.
So then what is it about apportionment that would change the rule, especially this type of apportionment, right? Because you have this odd situation, because, you know, the elephant in the room is we have Congress, right? So Congress provides benefits. It then conditions that in certain circumstances, for our purposes, when a veteran is incarcerated, Congress has made the determination, okay, you would normally be getting 50%, but you're incarcerated, so we're gonna make the policy judgment that you go down to 10%, okay? Mm-hmm. But then they say, but we recognize that you may have a family. So we know that you would otherwise be getting, in my hypothetical, that 40% delta. So we're gonna allow your family to get the benefit, right? But notice that when we get to that point, it's Congress has already made the determination that it doesn't want the veteran to get any more than 10 or half if it's only a 10 or zero, right? But I mean, you understand what I mean.
I do.
Wouldn't it be bizarre to say in that scenario that we've decided that you, the incarcerated person, shouldn't get the full benefit? We'll let your dependent get it through apportionment. But, oh, by the way, Mr. Veteran or Ms. Veteran, if you now then from prison divorce your spouse, you get half of it back, right? That would be the logic of this. And again, this isn't result driven. It's that those are the types of things that Manziel and McCarty looked at. Wouldn't that be going directly against what Congress said in the apportionment context.
I certainly understand what you're saying. I would point to the language of the statute in its use of the terms receive and compensation due, and its lack of use of terms such as extinguish or terminate or forfeit. I don't think the statute contemplates that these benefits are being, that these benefits cannot be, that these benefits won't, will cease to be legally owned, or the veteran will cease to have any legally recognizable property interest in the veteran, in the benefits. I think what the statute does is temporarily prevents the veteran from possessing them during a particular time period. And I would look at the underlying policy of supporting military families and the consistent policy of community property law to support families to argue that there's no conflict.
But why on that policy would it be supportive of families to allow the incarcerated veteran to get back 50% of the money that would otherwise stay 100% in this case with the spouse?
Ms. Donta, before you respond, Dawn, would you add another 5 minutes, please?
I definitely see the point that you're raising. I would point out that in based on the narrow facts of this case, the Fullers are married and have always been for purposes of these benefits. So I would pose that we may not need to reach the broader question of what happens to these benefits if they are subject to division. They are not subject to division in this case.
Well, but so the problem I'm having is we are making a rule that will apply to every single person, right? So I'm not sure the principled way to say, well, in the Fuller's case, he gets to pursue his appeal because he has a property interest in 50% of the apportioned benefits. But we don't have to worry about saying that he can do that because he's not going to use that and get divorced and take the benefits. I mean, if you can convince me that we can say that, that's fine, but I'm not sure how one does that as a matter of constitutional dimensions, as Judge Greenberg was saying.
Well, I suppose I would build on Judge Greenberg's suggestion that the veteran always has standing as one way to approach the issue. Another way to approach the issue might be to say that it might not be to issue an order that disability benefits are always community property, but to recognize that it, under the facts of this case, Mr. Fuller presently has an indirect economic interest in the apportionment because of his current marriage to Mrs. Fuller.
And I'm sorry to ask so many questions, but I'd like you to be precise. This goes to the Chief Judge's question. Is your position that Mr. Fuller is vindicating his interest, or is your position that Mr. Fuller is vindicating Mrs. Fuller's interest?
I believe he's vindicating both. I think that they have a unity of interest in the apportionment.
Fine. What can you point me to in the record that shows that he has the legal ability to advance her interest, right? Which would be under constitutional law, sort of third party standing, right? Sometimes somebody can do a third party, right? Or sometimes the law will allow somebody to be in the shoes of somebody else. So it's actually not technically third party. They're, you know, so for example, a guardian, right? A state appointed guardian could do that, right? Is there anything here that suggests that there is a legal basis on which Mr. Fuller is representing Mrs. Fuller's interests on a legal basis?
Sitting here, I can only point you to the evidence that Chief Judge Bartley pointed to, where Mrs. Fuller stated that her husband was acting on her behalf as a representative.
But would you agree with me as a legal matter that if I said to you, Ms. Danta, I heard you argue this morning, I think you're an excellent lawyer, I want you to act on my behalf in a breach of contract action, not as my lawyer, but as me. You'd agree with me that you would not have standing to go file a lawsuit on my behalf as you, the plaintiff, right?
I agree with that hypothetical.
And so the difference here is what? Mrs. Fuller says, I trust my husband to do this, right? There's no evidence that she is incompetent. And that's the only thing we have. And so it would have to be then that one person saying to a court, I want this person to be my representative, would then allow that person to drop off and the other person to go forward. And I think the chief judge is going to add some time.
Yep, let's add 5 minutes, please, Dawn.
Yes, I understand. I understand the distinction that you're making. And I'm afraid I don't have a response.
excuse me. I think I have a response. Isn't it his status as a veteran that makes the difference here? He's in a favored class of citizen, favored by Congress. Isn't his status as a veteran make a difference between the fact patterns that have been suggested and what we have here? Isn't that sufficient to go forward? There's no suggestion whatsoever that Mrs. Fuller objects. In fact, it's quite the contrary. So why can't we just decide on the narrow facts of this case?
Your Honor, I think that you can.
Thank you.
Ms. Danta, as to Manziel, why would a case, and I think Howell too, if I'm not mistaken, or McCarty, why would cases that are based on the Former Spouses Protection Act, or I forget whether it has a new name now, why would those even be relevant in this case where, again, the parties?
I don't believe that they are relevant. Okay. It's not the type of benefit that's being discussed in this case, and the language is different in the statutes.
Thank you.
So then just to follow up for a second on that point, so then somebody who it was in the position then of Mr. Manziel, who had disability benefits that were in lieu of disability, in lieu of military retirement pay, right, would then be potentially treated differently than somebody who has the same exact benefit but just didn't happen to have military retirement pay that it took the disability in lieu of. So in other words, if just assume with me for a second that the Supreme Court's decision in Manziel says that if you are a 20-year person, you've got military retirement pay, and you take disability pay in lieu of a portion of that, right? The Supreme Court says there, that's not subject to community property. But if you take away the fact that there happened to be military retirement pay, that person getting the same exact benefit, but just not in lieu of disability, could have a different outcome in your view?
May I ask you to repeat the question?
Sure. So just assume with me that the Supreme Court in Mizell said, okay, we said in McCarty that no military retirement pay is subject to community property, right? Then Congress steps in with the statute, and then we have Mizell, And the Supreme Court says, hey, Congress, we understand, we got it. You said military retirement pay is subject to community property. But then the Supreme Court says, but if somebody elects VA disability benefits in lieu of the military retirement pay, the Supreme Court says that's not subject to community property. Okay? Now, following on Chief Judge Bartley's question, right? That was a different area, right? So now assume that somebody isn't in a position to get military retirement pay at all, right? But they have exactly the same disability that allowed the first person in my hypothetical to take some pay in lieu of, okay? Are you saying that those two people could be treated differently, meaning the disability benefits in the first case are not subject to apportionment under community property, division under community property under Mizell, but the veteran in the second situation, their benefits would be subject to division?
Ms. Donta, before you respond there, let's add 10 minutes. Dawn, thank you.
And while you're thinking about this, right, the reason that I'm spending so much time on this, right, is that my view of this case changed dramatically after reading those Supreme Court cases. Because assume that one of us has to write something that says, you know, this place on First Street in Washington, the Supreme Court, well, you said this in Mizell about what VA disability benefits are in terms of community property in California. But we're going to say in this case that it's different, right? And so imagine me trying to write this. I need a path to be able to say that. You've given me one earlier that apportioned benefits are different, right? This is a different argument, right? Which is, well, that dealt with retirement pay and disability in lieu of, and so we can treat VA benefits standing alone differently. But I just need to have a justification where I would be able to say, and the reason I can do that is X. That's why I'm asking.
Does it aid in your analysis to point out that it is a veteran's choice to waive the retirement? It is a veteran's choice to make the waiver that you're talking about.
I have no idea. Right. That's a distinction. Right. I'm not sure how that plugs in. But, you know, I appreciate this because I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm literally trying to get the building blocks to say if I wanted to write an opinion in your favor. And to my colleague, Judge Greenberg, if we want to say a veteran can always appeal everything, well, that's easy. Right. And if you want to take that position, that's totally fine. Right. I tell you, that's not my position, right? I need a way to reconcile Mizell with, in the background, Belton, right? Which says the apportioned benefit is entirely different once it's in the hands of the dependent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I was asking. And I just wanted to explore that. So thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Would it aid the court to discuss any other issue related to standing this morning?
Well, I would move on. Personally, I have a question about your other arguments, and one of my questions is you cite like the duration of the veteran's incarceration as well as how far away he was from his spouse during his incarceration, mm-hmm. like Missouri to California, as factors that the RO should have thought about in tailoring its assistance efforts. Would the mere fact of incarceration put them on notice of special assistance being needed? Was the geographic distance required? What are your thoughts on that?
I believe that the fact of the incarceration is enough. to justify a heightened duty of assistance. And there's legal support for that in one of the cases cited in the brief, Wood versus Derblinski, where there is a true recognition of the practical realities that confront an incarcerated veteran, someone who cannot work face-to-face with representatives of the VA or anyone else to obtain benefits to which they are entitled. So certainly the fact of his incarceration alone is an important fact here. Exacerbating the need to assist Mr. Fuller is the fact that he is trying to get his wife apportionment benefits. And when you look at the face of the correspondence Mr. Fuller turned in, you can readily observe certain facts. And from his file, you can observe additional facts. If you're giving Mr. Fuller or any veteran the attention that they deserve, you're not considering these claims from a abstract perspective. You're considering the claims based on you're considering their individual claim. So here it was important to consider the fact that his incarceration started in 1999, and it was also important to consider the fact that his wife lived 2,000 miles away. I think that distinction is important because it means that when you're talking about financially strapped military families, the cost of a plane ticket to travel from California to Missouri is far more prohibitive than the cost of a tank of gas to drive to a facility where your spouse is incarcerated. So there's less of an opportunity for the Fullers to interact with each other than there would be if they lived more proximally. And all of that was apparent to the VA just from the information they had in Mr. Fuller's file and on the form he gave in.
Okay, thank you. And as far as I wanted to suggest this. So the cases, to go back to standing, the cases that talk about the veteran having a personal stake, and here he, you know, in Frank and others, he didn't have a personal stake, is the marital state enough to establish that in cases where there's no evidence of discord or legal separation or, you know, impending divorce or something like that? Would just the fact of the marital state possibly satisfy that requirement?
I think so when you're talking about community property jurisdictions, because there's a presumption that the property of one spouse that is acquired during the marriage is part of the marital estate. That's the fact that we have here.
Right. This case doesn't require us to decide this question, but like, why wouldn't that apply in general? You're married. You have a personal stake in what's going on financially and otherwise with the other person.
I'm not being a family law lawyer, I don't know for a fact that that is true in all cases. I do know that there are situations where spouses can hold property separate from each other. So I'd be cautious against making such a blanket assertion. I would prefer to say that in this particular case, you know, you are the case law that you were talking about, Ferenc and Belton, does have the courts. They don't apply some per se rule that a veteran can never have standing in an apportionment. Instead, they go through the trouble of making the analysis of whether there is a legally significant connection between the veteran and the apportionment. And I think all the court has to do here is do that analysis and recognize that under the facts of the case, Mr. Fuller had a legally significant connection to the apportionment.
Thanks.
If there are no other specific questions, I want to just get to this argument in the secretary's briefing that the appellant Thurman Fuller could not make a claim because he's not entitled to benefit to receive the payments himself as the veteran and not the dependent. And I just want to point out that there aren't supporting cases for that. I haven't seen in the definition of a claim any notion that Mr. Fuller can't be a claimant. I also think that the arguments go more to reasons for denying his claim rather than deciding whether he's owed a duty of assistance or due process rights. And so I think it's premature if the regional office looks at someone like Mr. Fuller and says, he's not legally entitled to benefits, so we don't owe him heightened duties. I think that ignores the overarching policy that this is not supposed to be is it all right if I finish this point? I'm sorry, it's on mute.
Yeah, go ahead and finish the sentence.
Okay. That it's a reason for denying the claim, but it's not a reason for denying him due process rights or consideration at the outset. I think he believes clearly that he is filing a claim, or he's clearly expressing his intent to get the apportionment. And I think the requirement to read claims and intent to file claims liberally requires the RO to do more than they did in this case.
Well, thank you, Ms. Donta. Mr. Morris, you may go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Your Honors, as a matter of law, appellant does not and cannot have a personal stake in the effective date of the payment of apportioned benefits to his wife. And therefore, the board's decision on the effective date issue should be set aside as ultra vires, and the current appeal should be dismissed. There are three independent and equally dispositive reasons that compel this. First, Your Honors, is that this court has held as much and its case law is controlling. Second, Your Honors, is federal law, specifically 38 U.S.C. 5301A and 10 U.S.C. 1408, the Uniformed Services Former Spouses Protection Act, preempts any state law that would include VA disability benefits as community property or otherwise subject them to marital property division. And third, Your Honor, is notwithstanding these broader laws, any state law that would purport to give an incarcerated veteran such as appellant a property interest in the apportioned part of their benefits is directly preempted by 38 U.S.C. 5313 that specifically prohibits that result. With the court's indulgence, I'd like to jump to the second and third points, which, consistent with this court's case law, prohibit appellant from relying on California or any state's community property or domestic relations laws to assert an interest in the apportioned payments made to his wife. Your Honors, under federal law, VA disability benefits are not subject to state community property laws. There are two relevant statutes. The first is 38 U.S.C. 5301A, which prohibits the assignment, seizure, or other transfer of interest in VA disability benefits unless expressly authorized by law. The second is 10 U.S.C. 1408, the Uniformed Services Former Spouses Protection Act, or USFSPA, which, responding to prior Supreme Court precedent, authorizes states to treat veterans' disposable military retired pay as community property and to divide it at divorce, but specifically excludes VA disability benefits from this grant of authorization and, as interpreted by the Supreme Court in Mansell v. Mansell, also preempts states from treating the portion of military retired pay waived to collect VA disability benefits as community or divisible marital property. Mansell.
Morris, but the Mansell and the other cases we have, though, were in the context of a divorce. And so why would or some other kind of marital discord, legal separation or something like that, I believe. So do you have any cases where that law has been applied where there is a seemingly happy, uncomplicated marriage involved?
Yes and no. I believe that Mansell itself, community property is inherently a division of property interest, and is no different than a formal division at divorce or in a marriage settlement agreement. Community property means that the property is divided 50-50. It imposes specific rights and obligations on the parties during the marriage itself based on the division of property interest.
I was asking you about cases regarding the USFPA. The very title of the statute talks about former spouses, not current spouses. So you were talking about the parameters of a community property state, but I'm talking about the statute that some of these Supreme Court cases are based on.
Yes, Your Honor, with the court's indulgence, though, if I could briefly summarize our interpretation and view of the relevance of Mansell, I believe that will address the court your question. Because it'll give a relevance to the cases that I can cite for that premise. But yes, there are. I believe that there are cases that address the division with respect to a still married couple, because that is the essence of the application of community property laws in general. They only apply where the couple is still married. The ramifications of that take place at divorce. So what Mansell did, it concerned the USFSPA, and the reason that the USFSPA is relevant is because absent express authorization to divide VA disability benefits, it can't be done. It cannot be subjected to any state law that would do it, whether it's community property laws or state court orders regarding property division at divorce. What Mansell made clear was not only that the USFSPA specifically excludes VA disability benefits from the grant, what it authorized states in terms of treating military pay as a community property, but it also closed the back door. The view that certain state courts had taken, and Mansell was actually a California case, that they could circumvent the protections of VA benefits by instead dividing the waived portion of the military retirement pay. So what Mansell did was it confirmed not only that VA benefits are protected, but also that the USFSPA preempts states from indirectly dividing beneficiaries' interest in VA disability benefits by instead assigning the interest in the portion of the military pay waived to collect such benefits. And as far as cases, Your Honor, there are numerous state court cases that have considered both the effects of 5301A, as well as the USFSPA and Mansell. They include cases from Iowa, Massachusetts, Montana, Texas, Washington, Illinois, and Kentucky. And depending on when these cases arose, whether they related specifically to 5301A or otherwise acknowledged Mansell as fully shutting down the door to any attempt to divide VA benefits, that just depends on when these cases arose. But it's perhaps even most significant to note.
Would you just clarify, though, the cases that you're looking at the citations to now, were those in the context of a couple that had no intention of divorcing and there was no legal separation, there was nothing? I mean, why would they even be talking about division of property then?
Well, that's where these statutes come into play. They exist, but absent some attempt to divide the property, there typically is no litigation. So those cases would inherently only arise at the point of separation or at the point of a marriage settlement agreement. While community property does impose obligations on both parties, I have yet to find cases that address that type of litigation. The litigation comes up at the point of divorce. But in a state such as California, the division of marital assets is based on the existence of those assets at the time of the marriage and the division of the property interest at the time of the marriage. And it's worth noting, Your Honor, that of the states that regard VA benefits as not being subjected to either community property and or marital asset division is California. In fact, California, as far back as at least 1978, has recognized that VA benefits are not subject to its community property laws. And that's the In Re Marriage of Stenquist case, which is a 1978 California Supreme Court case. More recently, and especially in light of Mansell and the USFSPA, the California appeals courts have recognized that Mansell fully shuts the door on any attempt to divide VA disability benefits to include by using that backdoor approach to get at instead the waived portion of the military retirement pay. And those cases include In Re Marriage of Chapman, a 2016 case, In Re Marriage of Casolini, a 2018 case, and In Re Marriage of Kremkin, a 1999 case. So given that we're talking about California, the fact that California does not recognize VA disability benefits as community property is dispositive, but we don't even need to get close to California law. I mean, that's what would apply. Ultimately, the question here is, would California subject the benefits in this case to its community property laws? And the answer is no. But we don't even get there because federal law preempts even that inquiry. California has recognized the federal preemption, but it's the federal law itself. And again, 5301A specifically prohibits the division or transfer of interest in VA disability benefits. And if the USFSPA does not authorize it, which some state courts, including California, had tried to suggest that it did, what we fall back on is 5301A and the Supreme Court's decision in McCarty, which otherwise said that military benefits in general were off limits. And it's worth noting that the Supreme Court, while Mansell concerned the USFSPA, Justice O'Connor did note in her in her separate opinion that 5301A, or I think it was 3101A at the time, specifically prevented the garnishment of benefits. And the Supreme Court, again, in Howell v. Howell, in its majority opinion, also cited 5301A for the proposition that a state can't give away VA disability benefits. So again, that's the backdrop, that's the basis. So if the USFSPA doesn't grant the authorization, and it does not, then there is no basis to subject VA disability benefits to state community property laws. And that, Your Honor, though, leads me to the third broader point that I have, which is that ultimately we don't even need to get to these issues because there's a more directly preempting federal statute, and that is 5313. Which affirmatively requires the reduction of compensation payments to incarcerated veterans and makes clear that such veterans are not entitled to payments in excess of that reduced amount. In other words, the apportionment is a part of the disability payment to which Congress has said the incarcerated veteran is expressly prohibited from receiving. Any recognition of community property rights in the apportioned benefits of an incarcerated veteran would circumvent Congress's clear and unequivocal objective of denying those veterans a right to payments above and beyond their statutorily reduced payments.
Mr. Morris, as to that last point, are you actually, that only applies to VA, right? I mean, would you agree with me that it means VA has to take away half? But if Mrs. Morris in this case, Mrs. Fuller in this case, received the apportionment and 2 days later wanted to send it to Mr. Morris in his prison facility, if she could. Okay. I don't know whether you can send money. I don't know the rules on that, especially in Missouri or the federal prison he was in. But I mean, she could do that, right? That there's nothing to prevent her from doing that.
The money, once it is received by her, she can choose. She has a sole right to decide what happens to that money. What federal law prevents, though, is any action by federal government, unless authorized, or state governments from determining what happens to the interest in that money. And this is a matter of direct federal preemption, as this court recognized, I believe it was noted in the Morris case, The federal law affecting veterans benefits will preempt state laws that impede the objectives of federal legislation, even in areas of, you know, of traditional state concern. And that is what we have. We have a very specific federal statute that says this veteran, the appellant, as an incarcerated veteran, was only entitled to X amount of payment. Everything above that, Congress authorized to be apportioned to an authorized beneficiary. It's further worth noting that under the regulatory section 38 CFR 3.665, it specifically identifies those beneficiaries. An appellant is not one of them. It is only the dependent. It is the spouse, the child or children, or a dependent parent or parents. Appellant is not one of them. So federal regulation also specifically excludes appellant from receiving any financial benefit, you know, directly from these benefits.
But we're not, he's not trying to get his, I'm looking at the evidence that we have before us, which is that she wanted him to file this. She wants him to pursue this on her behalf. And it's not that he's trying to get his hands on the money, and that those statutes that you just cited and regulations would be violated. He's using this for standing purposes only.
I understand that, Your Honor, but 2 points to that. Your Honor's original point about, well, if the wife wanted to give him the money, if that were simply that, if that were the standard, then anyone to whom a veteran promised money or said, I'll give you money to, would have standing to challenge what happens to those benefits in court. And we know that that is not permissible. Yes, the veteran is using this to assert standing in this case, and I would like to get back to that word in a moment, but it does, what he's relying on is a property interest. It's not a theoretical property interest that he's asserting based on a legal argument. He is asserting an actual property interest in these benefits that not only are non-divisible by, you know, and therefore not subject to community property, but again, specifically precluded by 5313, he is not entitled to be a beneficiary of those apportioned payments. And I would like,
Let me interrupt here. You said that he's asserting a property interest, and I believe our other cases talk about having a personal stake in the outcome. Are those two equivalent in your view? The property interest and having
a property interest. I'm sorry. A property interest would give the veteran a personal stake in this case. And yes, but I would like to clarify one point, which I believe goes generally to some of the questions that have been asked, but also Judge Greenberg, to one of Judge Greenberg's points, which is that we're not really talking about standing, and certainly not in the Article III sense. Article III standing doesn't apply to the administrative body. What we're talking about here is jurisdiction and the board's jurisdiction. Ordinarily, and that, well, that jurisdiction is premised on the proper filing of a notice of disagreement. Ordinarily, that can be filed by the claimant or someone that's specifically authorized to act on their behalf. In cases such as this, which are simultaneously contested claims, what we have, it can be filed, the notice of disagreement can be filed by a claimant or a person adversely affected by the decision. That adversely affected language is also used in this court's jurisdictional statute. And this court has found that it mirrors essentially the Article III standing. But it is important to recognize that this is not actually Article III. This is not something that something that the court has simply adopted as part of its jurisprudence. This is jurisdictional. And if the board doesn't have jurisdiction, and it didn't, then this court does not have jurisdiction either. And so sliding somebody in, you know, in to be a claimant to say that, you can argue this case, means that this court is finding that the board had jurisdiction, that this person was entitled to file a notice of disagreement. Getting back to your point, though, as far as the property interest, yes, that would suffice to give the appellant a personal stake. And that is what this court and what other courts have discussed in terms of the interest. He has to be adversely affected. He was not. not by this, the timing of the start date for when the payments, the apportioned payments were made to his wife. Why? Because those payments didn't belong to him. Why didn't they belong to him? Because they were specifically authorized by Congress to be given to a certain beneficiary, which he is not entitled to be. And because appellants cannot rely on any state law to give him an interest in those benefits, which Congress specifically denied him.
Mr. Morris, let me stop you there. So I wanted to ask you the same question that I asked of appellant's counsel, and you touched on it briefly, but Judge Meredith's memorandum decision several years ago in this kind of same claim stream here, recited the spouse's statement that he was her guardian and that he was doing this on her behalf. And I know that 3.155 allows someone to pursue a claim if they're next friend of claimant and the claimant is incapacitated, et cetera. So what do we have any evidence in the record that is contrary to the spouse's statement about this situation?
We do not have anything in the record that acknowledges the spouse as a guardian. That is a legal role.
I was asking whether we had any evidence contrary to Ms. Fuller's statement that he was acting on her behalf here and that he was her guardian.
In the record before the court, I do not believe that we do. I do not believe, though, that that is relevant. Whether the veteran is acting on behalf of his wife is a fully distinct inquiry from whether he has himself, you know, has this quote-unquote administrative standing to pursue this appeal. The appellant has not pursued the argument that he was acting on behalf of the wife. Certainly, and I do believe, again, I don't believe it's in the record before the court, but I do believe that he was specifically found not to be the wife's guardian. I can check that, but in either case, he was certainly not adjudicated to be the wife's guardian. If he was, then yes, this would be proper. He would be standing in the wife's shoes. But what he is trying to do now is assert her interests. That does not give rise to standing. That certainly doesn't authorize him to file the notice of disagreement, which is ultimately what this comes down to. That is why the veteran doesn't have this. He is not entitled to pursue this. He did not meet the requirements to file a notice of disagreement because he is not a person who was adversely affected by the start date for the apportioned payments in this case. My intent is not to suggest that he couldn't be, if he was an authorized representative of the wife, have done these things, but simply usurping her rights and attempting to litigate them when he is not her and he has not been adjudicated to be able to stand in her position, that is wrong. To the extent that there may be gripes with how this case was handled, those gripes can be vindicated only by the appellant's wife or somebody who's authorized administratively to act on her behalf. I hope I answered.
Could I ask a quick question? It flows from Chief Judge Bartley's reference to Judge Meredith's memorandum decision. The question comes in two different varieties, but it gets to the same point. So number one, Judge Meredith had to write the memorandum decision because the dispute between the parties at the time was on remedy. They, both the secretary and the appellant, agreed that that the board should have considered whether state law provided a basis for standing, right? And then, of course, we actually have a decision that embodies that point. Is there any legal significance to either the secretary's concession earlier about this point, or leaving that aside, the fact that there is a judicial decision, which of course is not precedential, but is binding on the parties here, that the board needed to consider this, right? Because the secretary's position now is different. It's inconsistent with both those things, right? It's not a criticism, that's just a description. So, but what I want to get to is there any legal significance to either one of them?
No, Your Honor, there is not. To the extent that the secretary had taken the position to remand this case for the board to consider whether California state law applied, in hindsight, perhaps the matter could have been resolved in legal arguments at the time, but I don't think it was unfair to provide the board with an opportunity in the first instance to make the assessments. And also, being unclear, the board did have to make certain findings, such as the fact that the veteran was incarcerated. Ultimately, that's dispositive here, that the veteran was married and so on and so forth. So I do think that there were some specific findings that did need to be made to establish the foundation. And so it was not inappropriate to send the case back for the board to discuss this issue, especially recognizing those times where the parties have come to court, where the board didn't make an operative finding of fact, and then after all the argument, the case has to go back to the board to make that finding because the court can't do it in the first instance. But I believe that was the secretary's position, which was simply that the board should have discussed, that the board should discuss this. And I believe that's what the court in the single judge decision ultimately held, was that this is something for the board to discuss. The fact that the board did discuss it and the board didn't make a finding is also, Your Honor, of no legal significance. This was a jurisdictional determination, which is ultimately a question of law, which this court has held that it exercises de novo review over. Because again, this court's jurisdiction derives from the board. If the board doesn't have it, then this court doesn't have it. Yes, there are several factual findings that the board made. And those findings, the court is to pay deference to. But as far as both the applicability of California law, it requires an interpretation of the board's jurisdictional regulation. It requires an interpretation of federal laws, including 5103A, 10 U.S.C. 1408, Supreme Court precedent, including Mansell, Howell and McCarty. But ultimately, it involves solely a legal question. So the fact that the board even may have characterized this as a factual finding is irrelevant. I would add one more point to that, which is that even if we assumed for the sake of argument that the board made a favorable finding of fact as the appellant has alleged, even if we assume that somehow this a jurisdictional finding is a finding of fact, this court is permitted to reverse findings of fact that are adverse to a claimant, which the court has found it restricts it from reversing or disturbing findings of fact that are favorable to the claimant. It is important to emphasize here that appellant is not the claimant. The claimant in this case is still the wife. Regardless of who is entitled to pursue this appeal, the claimant is the wife. So this is not a fact favorable to the claimant. Again, it's not a fact, but this pertains to the wife and the wife alone. In fact, any determination by this court that appellant has a property interest in the apportioned part of his benefits is objectively not favorable to the claimant. It is not favorable to the wife. Regardless of whether they assert their interest to align, it is taking away a part of the wife's interest in her payments. And that ultimately is why, Your Honor, this case should not move, cannot move forward. There is no basis to give the appellant a property interest in the wife's benefits. And the appellant here is arguing someone else's rights. Someone else's rights, which are conditioned on the court's acceptance that he has a property interest in benefits that were specifically and exclusively given to his wife. Any issues should be raised by the wife. Did that answer Your Honor's question, Judge Allen?
It did, thank you.
Your Honors, if there are no further questions on this, I would just like to conclude by saying that again, at the end of the day, appellant is trying to assert an interest in payments that he was specifically denied by Congress and in which, as a matter of law, he has no legal significant interest in. Because appellant is not entitled to be a beneficiary of the apportioned payments, and because those payments belong solely to his wife, he was not an adversely affected person authorized to file a notice of disagreement with the effective date decision. The board had no jurisdiction over the appeal. Its decision on the matter was thus ultra vires, and because of that, this court lacks jurisdiction to review the issue. Accordingly, the board decision should be set aside and this appeal should be dismissed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Ms. Dante, you may move ahead with your rebuttal.
Your Honors, at this time, I do not have any points to make in rebuttal.
I have one question for you, Ms. Dante.
Yes.
Are you maintaining today to the court that Mr. Fuller is the legal guardian of Mrs. Fuller?
Yes.
What can you point to for that? That's a legal determination. So what can you point to for that?
Merely the memorandum decision where Mrs. Fuller states that she intends him to pursue the claim and that he is her guardian.
So I just want to be very, 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 very clear. Your position to the court today is that there has been a legal determination that Mr. Fuller is the guardian of Mrs. Fuller.
Are you asking whether the decision held that
No. Okay. Mm-hmm. First of all, whether Mrs. Fuller says to somebody, I want this person to be my guardian. That's one thing, right? Let's assume that's true. Judge Meredith's decision has that comment in it, right? I'm asking a verifiable question. In order for somebody to be a legal guardian for somebody, there has to be some court that transfers from one person to another certain rights, right? Some states, it's all or nothing, right? Other states like Florida, where I happen to be sitting at the moment, it's right by right by right. So you could transfer the right to manage finances, but not the right to decide where to live, for example, or something, right? Regardless of, is your position that there is some court that has at some time designated Mr. Fuller as the guardian, the legal guardian for Mrs. Fuller?
No, that is not my position. I am not aware of any court decision establishing guardianship.
So basically then, the notion of somebody being a guardian in the terms of the memoranda decision is more colloquial than it is legal. Is that fair?
That seems fair.
Thank you. Thank you for the direct answer. I appreciate it.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Judge Greenberg.
If I may, counsel, does it make any difference whether he's the guardian or not in terms of the issues we have to deal with?
I do not, based on the point you made at the outset that the veteran always has standing. And I do not, based on the arguments that I have made, that Mr. Fuller himself has a property interest in the apportionment.
I'd like to go back to something the counsel for the secretary made. The general statutory scheme is that when a veteran is incarcerated, the amount of benefits are reduced under the theory that he doesn't require the full benefit because his everyday needs are in effect being paid by the state or the federal government in terms of the prison. He gets his meals, his shelter, medicine, medical treatments, and so forth. Is that really, what's your reply to that? Is this apportionment affected in any way by the congressional determination that we're not going to, in fact, double compensate the veteran while he's incarcerated?
I certainly, yes, I recognize that that is a policy consideration, and I believe that it was even discussed in the legislative history. I would respond that to the extent it appears in the legislative history, that's not the first resource that you look to determine the meaning of the statute. You look at the plain meaning of the statute itself. And I do not believe that the plain meaning of the statute supports the idea that Mr. Fuller can never have, as a per se rule, any property interest in the apportionment.
And that's the legal determination you're asking us to make.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Ms. Donta, on the record before us, did VA challenge the spouse's statement that Mr. Fuller was her guardian, or did they ever, they have a duty to notify a claimant of what's necessary to prove the claim. Did they ever notify Mr. Fuller or Ms. Fuller that they needed evidence of formal guardianship?
No, they didn't send. In terms of what was sent to Mrs. Fuller, there was the single letter that gave her a list of verification information to verify her entitlement to the apportionment. In terms of what was sent to Mr. Fuller, there was merely the notice that his benefits would be withheld due to his incarceration, and that he could identify dependents to receive the withheld portions. That is one of our complaints, that the VA sat idly by while the Fullers thought that they had done what they had to do in order to receive benefits.
That's your due process argument.
Correct.
Thank you, Ms. Donta. We appreciate all of the arguments from both of the parties, and the case is submitted for consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court is in recess.